Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Gene Koo. He's the executive director of iCivics, the educational organization and web presence founded by former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor to reverse America's declining civic knowledge and participation. Prior to heading up iCivics, Gene was a senior client manager for Blue State Digital. Gene, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's start with basics. Give me a brief overview of the kind of work that the organization does.
Sure. What iCivics does is provide innovative resources to help teachers prepare the next generation of citizens. And specifically, we're looking mostly at middle school kids. Our materials are developed for a seventh grade reading level. And we really wanted to make civics fun and engaging, very different from the kind of civics certainly that I had in high school, the kind of civics that Justice O'Connor had in middle and high school. And we started out with creating video games. Really just kind of jumping into the 21st century technology from 19th century technology of textbooks and looking at how to make civics something engaging, relevant, fun even. And we now have 17 video games that cover all sorts of subject matter from the three branches of the government. We're about to have a game come out about federalism, about local government, also about civic engagement, not just the government, but how to get involved in your local community. And that's kind of the tentpole of our resources and the, you know, all the materials in between, the meat and potatoes, are lesson plans that help teachers put on engaging and fun classes. And so we now offer enough materials for teachers to put on an entire semester's worth of civic education, and all of it's free and available on iCivics.org.
Is your interest in the organization driven more by the politics interest or the interest in education?
It's actually everything. It's an amazing confluence of my background, both in law, in education, and even in the use of video games in education and learning.
Is there something about Justice O'Connor's life beyond the obvious things that made her pick this issue to get so heavily involved in after she left the bench?
So when Justice O'Connor was leaving the bench, she looked around and realized that the judiciary was in trouble because people were no longer respecting it and attacking it. And, of course, the judiciary, unlike the other two branches of government, has no natural constituency. It only has the trust of the public. And the whole entire project started out initially as simply educating young people about how courts work. And then pretty soon she realized, hey, you know, the American public and kids don't really understand how any of the branches of government work. I think she's uniquely situated because she was actually had served in all three branches of government. She had been in the administrative branch. She had been actually majority leader of the Senate in Arizona. And that certainly, I'm sure, had some effect on her judicial temperament as well on the bench.
And you mentioned that you are targeting middle school kids. Why did you make that decision? Why not younger children, or why not high school?
Sure. Well, you know, civics education used to be something that schools would engage in from K through 12. It was actually the original reason why we have public schools in the United States back in the early 19th century when the various states started establishing public schools. And focus on civic education has really been in decline, especially since the 1960s, and largely has retreated in most states to the 12th grade. I went to public school in New York, and I had civic my government class was senior year, second semester, which is, of course, the perfect time to zone out and not pay attention to anything. We targeted middle school because that's where we saw the realistic the confluence of need and realistically being able to get into schools. Since there already still was government in most states in senior high school, we looked at middle school and realized that that was actually the moment developmentally when young people are really starting to look beyond themselves. They're really starting to think about society. If you've ever worked with adolescents, you know one of their favorite phrases is, "That's not fair." Mm. And it's a perfect opportunity to talk about fairness and what is fair, what is just, and how do you want to reflect that in a society that you live in.
And there's an old Jesuit saying I was reminded of when I was thinking about your focus on younger students. Give me the child and I will give you the man. Are you trying to do some kind of less intense version of that when it comes to making active citizens?
Absolutely. You know, I think we're looking initially at providing the basic knowledge that you need to understand how our system works, but we're increasingly looking at the kinds of skills you need to practice, and especially the dispositions. Because the thing that I think lasts with you is when we really thought about what we wanted young people to walk away with from our program, it was something as simple as following the news and caring about and seeing that it's relevant.
So you mentioned that, and I was going to ask you about that later, ask you about it now, following the news. So how are you dealing with that goal given the change in the news media environment? Because here in Syracuse, I'll just make it local, if following the news meant reading a local newspaper in print, you're able to do that about half as much as you were able to do a few months ago.
Sure. And to be very frank, we're not tackling that problem yet. We're looking at it in terms of really doing the research and figuring out how to get involved. Because the problem is, as you describe, one is the decline of traditional media, but more alarmingly is the rise of the filter bubble, right? The idea that you get your news through these mediated sources that are increasingly giving you only the news that you want to see. And the idea of media literacy is evolving so quickly beyond, you know, it used to be critical thinking about what you're reading. Now we have to think critically about what we're even seeing in the first place. And so media literacy is evolving so quickly that the idea of creating a curriculum to get ahead of it is quite challenging. And so we're really being careful about how to do that.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Gene Koo, Executive Director of iCivics, an organization dedicated to enhancing civic engagement and civic knowledge. Well, what would you regard as your organization's biggest successes so far?
What we've been able to figure out is how to reach average teachers and average schools and thereby be able to have a scalable solution for as many schools and ultimately as many young people as possible. So to date, we've signed up over 30,000 teachers. And let me just emphasize, by average, I don't mean that these are in any way denigrating the dedication and skill of the teachers. It's just simply that most teachers in most school districts don't have an enormous amount of resources available to them, whether we're talking about technology, whether we're talking about budget, even time in the school day to devote to a subject. So what we're really looking at is the constraints of a lot of teachers, figuring out how to work around that and still develop materials that will benefit students' civic literacy.
And I've read a lot, and I've also experienced this as a teacher at a university, to the effect that although younger citizens relative to the past are very engaged in terms of volunteer efforts and in service efforts and doing community work, they don't connect that kind of experience to politics and the political world, and they remain disengaged from and often alienated from politics or anything that they conceptualize as political. And that's true even post-Obama. So I wanted to get your impressions of that as a challenge and to see what thoughts you have about why that's the case. Why are younger people throwing that wall up when it comes to something that's regarded as political?
That's a great question. Empirically, I think when you look around, in some ways, this generation has been characterized as more politically active than previous generations, but that doesn't necessarily contradict what you just said, which is most, members of this generation, frankly, every generation preceding, are not necessarily that politically active, even if some of them are more so. There is a big disconnect, I think, between kind of service and political involvement within the area of civic education. We've had a evolution from, for example, service learning, where the idea was just get out into the community and do something for that community, and what is now increasingly called action civics, in which it's the idea that you might start with something that would be considered a traditional service learning project, but that evolves into, you know, increasingly looking at root causes and why does this stream keep filling with pollution and litter rather than just simply cleaning up the litter. The obstacles there, I think, are manifold. One of them is that increasingly we don't want controversy in our schools. I think that's been, studied very thoroughly. And teachers are afraid, and there are many, many examples of teachers trying to get into even a political discussion. Forget about getting involved in politics and being accused of being biased in one direction or the other. even if all they're doing is presenting both sides of an argument, because our communities are now increasingly homogenous in our politics, you know, we're not it's very hard to present yourself as being neutral because it's not perceived as such. So we're starting to push politics out of this subject, even though it's the basis of this subject, because of that fear. And in many ways, that fear then begets self-censorship.
And when I went onto your website, you mentioned this before about the kinds of things you do. You talked about the games that you folks have created. I was really struck by all of those online gaming exercises. And you've got them for jury deliberations, presidential decision-making, judicial deliberation, and others. And it reminded me of a couple of online civic examples that I had seen previously by government entities that I thought were useful and clever. For example, there was a budget exercise in Maine where the citizens were challenged to balance the budget with real numbers and then submit their spending and their tax choices to a registry. And then there was a similar national exercise in France, too, that took place. So tell me what you're trying to do with all these exercises. What's your goal there?
Absolutely. The exciting thing about video games and civics is that video games as a medium are really best at teaching and conveying how a system works. If you look at other media, for example, you would look at film or television, and those are really great at conveying emotion and telling stories. And there are certain things for which that's the best way to teach. When you look at how our government works, how the budget works, using a game allows you to fiddle with all the different dials, for example, in the case of the budget, and see what the consequence is. And, you know, then hit the reverse button, then try something else and see what the consequence of it is going the other direction if you, you know, cut the defense budget instead of, you know, the welfare budget or whatever. So in terms of how the three branches interact, in terms of how the state and federal governments interact, these are all systems. They're all bound by rules, and that's fundamentally what a video game is. It's a system of rules. And so there's a really nice mapping of one onto the other in terms of being an appropriate medium for teaching.
And I've also heard the phrase TurboTax approach in this, and that, you know, in the sense that if you were to sit someone down and say, okay, I'm going to teach you how the tax code works, you'd never get anywhere. But if you have them get on TurboTax and do their own taxes, in a sense, they'll learn it from the inside out. It sounds like that's kind of going on too there, right?
Yes, and it's also taking, in the case of TurboTax, some of the drudgery out of it, right? I mean, yeah. You know, TurboTax isn't—I would certainly not call it a game.
Right.
And it's questionable, for example, whether some of these budget exercises are games because, you know, you have to kind of ask, is there a goal or is there different outcomes? And quite frankly, at an aesthetic level, do they give you enough, you know, bleeps and bloops to kind of also keep you interested at a different level? But, you know, you can really get to some of the what I think are the best use of these of this kind of medium is can you take these systems questions and raise it to the level of what the moral, you know, stake is at the end of the day. If you could take that budget exercise and then in some more kind of emotional or visceral way show what the actual outcome is of your choices rather than simply, oh, well, here's a number, but rather here's the consequence for people you care about or maybe even people you don't but should care about. And I think that's when you're really starting to see the power of the medium.
And to follow up on precisely that point, it seemed to me one of the other advantages of this kind of approach is that if you go through this, particularly, let's say, with a budget exercise, you'll have a better appreciation at the end of the day for the difficult trade-offs, the difficult decisions that people making budgets, our legislators, have to make. Because oftentimes I think we look at this and we say, oh, the answer's obvious. If these jerks could just, you know, get together and agree, it would all be taken care of. But you have a better sense of, hey, this is difficult. And you have kind of an empathy then for the process that you might not have had before.
I think that's a great point. Is actually empathy for the process is a lot of what we're missing right now. Mm-hmm. Is there's a belief that all things can be done if only you listen to me. And being able to step back and see, for example, we actually do have a game about the budget. Called People's Pie, which is very similar to what you described with, you know, different kinds of graphics. And you try to balance the federal budget, and it's a really tough exercise. And actually, unfortunately, for that reason, kind of isn't necessarily our most popular game. But it is students and classes do play that. There's also a game where you make laws and you try to push a piece of legislation through and begin to see very quickly why you have to make compromise along the way. and you begin to understand a little bit more about what that means in a democracy, that it's not an authoritarian regime where you just get to dictate, hey, this is the law and here's how it's going to go.
My guest is Gene Koo. He's the executive director of iCivics, the organization and web presence founded by former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Well, what do you do with the way that Washington has been functioning, or perhaps better phrased, dysfunctioning of late? How do you work with that reality to promote the message that people should want to be engaged and involved?
That's a great question. I think for the age group that we're working with, we really try to portray kind of the system as it maybe was intended to be. But I also think that there's some myths about the democracy that we're trying to address. And I know that you had Jean Thero Harris on your program a couple of weeks ago talking about Rosa Parks and the myths about her. And I kind of call this the Rosa Parks problem. There's this idea that you can teach what civics is by, you know, only looking at the great heroes. And I think it is important to show young people that they can make a difference by looking at these folks. But I also think it, as you discussed in that program, the bigger picture in a democracy is actually that you have to get together with other people, because it's not a dictatorship of one person saying we must do this thing, but rather the way that it works in our system as it's evolved over time is you actually have to gather power across a community. And so what we're also trying to show is that, if you're frustrated, maybe it's about kind of getting together with other people who are frustrated, not just about you fuming nowadays in front of your computer in the basement.
And I was also wondering whether you're helped in that endeavor by the fact that Justice O'Connor was known as more of a moderate, you know, a swing vote on the court. Does that give you some better traction in trying to get people to think about this in a different way?
Sure. Well, other than the fact that she hates the term swing vote, because it implies that she wasn't principled when she was. It just happened to be that she occupied a particular position in the ideological spectrum or the particular people who comprised the court at the time. In any event,
I should say the fifth vote.
And actually, she would point out, well, why is she number five instead of number one on that
right.
list? But in any event, no, I think one thing that we have been very, you know, careful to do and also very lucky about is being nonpartisan and non-ideological, which is, as you can imagine, extremely difficult in this day and age. We work very, very hard to make sure that all of our materials are balanced and don't favor any side of any issue and really are above reproach.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and I'm talking with Gene Koo from the iCivics organization. Well, obviously, you rely a lot on the internet for this endeavor, and the internet's effect on politics is its own huge topic. So this is a big question, but if you could boil it down, how do you think the internet has changed our political life so far?
We're at a point right now where the science of manipulating a public opinion is proceeding at a lightning pace, is proceeding at basically entrepreneurial speed, where the iterations on these questions are happening incredibly fast. If you're out there looking at the technology and how they're being tested minute by minute, literally, every single piece of technology is being tested to its most basic elements of what color should this button be in order to produce better results. Meanwhile, on the other side of the equation, the science of teaching and educating people to think critically about the information they're being presented with is barely crawling along. The two are not matched, and that is really the one of the biggest challenges that we face right now.
And you mentioned earlier in this vein the problem that sometimes gets called balkanization, where people are seeking out information on the internet and finding only things that they already agree with or are comfortable with. There are some other problems, too, that people have identified. I wanted to get your reactions to them. One of them is the kind of interactions that you have there, and in particular, the limits on the human dimension of the exchange, so that the problem is that something essential to politics is being taken out of the equation when it takes place online. I guess a more academic way to say this is that the self that one finds on the internet is a thin self rather than a full self. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that that's a problem and a challenge. I think on the one hand, it might be exaggerated a little bit, and those of us who are really deeply steeped in politics will find what we will find there. But that the reality is that I think what a lot of people are instead wringing their hands out about are that people aren't seeking out politics enough, and more people are interested in looking at pictures of cats. And so how do you actually get to this place where you have a problem to begin with about people, reinforcing their political opinions? But, it is a real challenge. And I will admit right now that I do actually get a good percentage of my news through Facebook, and that is not a neutral source.
And another big concern, and a while back there were entire books being written about this, is the concerns about the digital divide. And this is, obviously brings up the small d Democratic concern that access to and comfort with and knowledge of digital technologies is not something that's shared across society. And so it only adds to the skewing toward the better off. Do you think that's a relevant concern?
I think the concerns that were originally raised, that the term digital divide was originally coined to look at access to the internet. And, that's still important. And when we look at it in terms of just even which schools are able to use our video games, there are still schools that we've been talking about one-to-one computing technology for decades, and there are schools who are not there yet, even as we're trying to roll out iPads or whatever in schools at the same time. So there is definitely an access problem, and I think that's important. But I think the bigger issue that's been raised more recently has been digital participation or creation. Not just are you getting your information and accessing it, but are you able to participate meaningfully and contribute to the digital polis. These are the kinds of skills that I think we ought to be thinking more about when we're thinking about civic skills that young people have. Can they not just get and critically assess information that they're seeing online, but can they actually use this new medium, and not just medium, but use this new, commons, this new community, and be able to build power on that?
Well, let me get to the three questions at the end. First, what's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
Sure. Well, everyone's talking right now about Sheryl Sandberg, Lean In, and right now my wife and I are both leaning in. So actually, if we're both leaning at the same time, it's kind of like a revolving door. So I think that's really the description of where we are right now. We're both kind of leaning in and out at the same time while we are doing our jobs and also having two young kids at home.
Second, what's your worst trait?
I think it's actually being a lawyer or being a lawyer by training, which is to say people always talk about how law school sharpens your thinking, and metaphorically, if you think about what sharpening means, when you sharpen a knife, you're actually taking things away. And that means, along the way, I think my wife will agree with this, have kind of in favor of having more critical thinking, also perhaps lost a little bit of empathetic thinking.
And finally, what professional or creative achievement in your life so far has surprised you the most?
I think the thing that surprised me the most is that it actually takes a long time to learn something. I mean, I'm of the generation where, you're moving from job to job every 2 years, 3 years. And, this position has really helped me realize that actually 2 years is just barely scratching the surface. And, I'm kind of wondering what happens to the entire generation that's kind of hopping in that way.
That was Gene Koo, and the organization is iCivics, which you can find on the web at icivics.org. Gene, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
I'm Grant Reher. Join me again next week on WRVO Public Media for more conversation in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher. Associate producers include Bethany Wallowender, Kelly Coleman, John Fornoff, Stephanie Lee, Hennish Pullickel, and Sophia Celeste Tate, and recording engineer Tom Fazio. For more information on the Campbell Conversations, visit WRVO.org.